So before we can write down the full Lagrangian of the standard model, there's just one other housekeeping item of machinery. So yesterday, we looked at two component spinners. Or Weyl spinners, van der Weerden spinners. And that's necessary because the standard model is built out of spin 1/2 particles that are most conveniently thought of in the two-component form. There's one other ingredient that we need to understand how the standard model works, and that's spontaneous symmetry breaking. Because in the standard model in the electroweak sector, SU2 left cross U1 hypercharge is broken down to the U1 electromagnetism. And this happens because the Higgs acquires a vacuum expectation value. What it means for our purposes is that the Higgs field is turned on in the universe. Yesterday was all about spinners. Today's going to be all about scalars. And scalars are special because they don't carry any additional bells and whistles. They're just numbers, and so I can turn on a number at every point in the universe, and that's still a Lorentz invariant thing. I can't do that to a spinner, to a vector. If I were to give, say, some background value to a vector, a gauge field, or to some preferred direction in space, that breaks Lorentz invariance. That's not true with a scalar because the Lorentz transformation law is such that any scalar quantity is just maps onto itself if it's given a background value. And we're going to start with an example. Of how this works. So let's consider an ON global symmetry. Acting on some fields phi. And I'll define a phi vector to just be an n component object, phi 1, phi 2, dot, 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 phi sub n. So ON is the rotation group. In n dimensions. And we might recall that the generators of the rotation group satisfy the commutation relation with a Levi-Civita tensor. What we'll see happening in this example is going to be pretty generic to any global symmetry. I should specify that this is what we'll see. The generic features of this are going to apply to any continuous symmetry. And we're used to seeing a theory like this. There are no gauge fields, by the way. It's just the scalars themselves. But we've got a bunch of them. And then every time we perform an ON gauge transformation, well, it's not technically a gauge transformation, just a symmetry transformation, it just shuffles these fields so that each group element just tells you that each one of these is now to be rewritten as a linear combination of all the others. And we can write down the Lagrangian for this ON theory with scalars in the following way. What do I have here? Okay. So normal derivative, not the covariant derivative. I can write this just as a dot product in ON space. And I'll give them all the same masses. So everything I write down in the scalar potential just has to be rotationally symmetric. So it's going to be built out of dot products like these. That's manifestly rotationally invariant. And I'll add a quartic term. Squared. Okay. So what is this theory like to do? Well, this is a really boring theory. because if we write down the potential, so the potential for this, it only depends on the norm. And the potential is just m squared over 2 phi squared plus lambda over 4 phi to the 4. In the usual way, I'm just being sloppy and writing it here. And if we think about how this looks, there's some v of phi. And let's say this is phi 1. It's just something that looks like a parabola in every direction. There are n directions, but we have two here because of budget cuts. And we can think about, we define a quantum field theory as oscillations about the minimum of this potential, because everything that we've learned about Feynman diagrams and about propagators is really just a fancy way of talking about a harmonic oscillator that's perturbed in some way. So the kinetic and the mass terms are quantized as harmonic oscillators. This is treated as a perturbation away from that. And there are techniques to figure out scattering amplitudes and so on. And that's the whole story, right? We've all seen this, and it's not very interesting. But what is interesting, interesting tweak. So let m squared go to minus mu squared. So just by fiat, I'm going to take the mass term and I'm going to make it negative. So this is crazy. Mainly because now the potential is really going to look like this. Well, I should make it a little neater. Where this is just some number that we'll call V sub phi. Phi 1, this will be phi 2, and there's a degenerate manifold of directions that tell you exactly where the minimum of this potential is. And we're going to consider the kind of field theory that we get when we expand about the minimum of this theory, because it's only well-defined in the usual way if we're defining the ground state around the true minimum of the theory. So the potential is minimized for some vector that I'll call phi sub 0 vector squared. And that'll be mu squared over lambda. And I'll define this to be v squared phi. OK, so this is not at 0. That's the crucial thing. Not at 0. And this wouldn't be possible for a spinner. It wouldn't be possible for a vector, for a tensor. You would ruin Lorentz symmetry in the universe if that were true, but it is possible for a scalar, and scalars are a special case. Now, this is just a number. This is just a number, and it doesn't depend on the direction. So without loss of generality, wo log, I can define, or I can perform a rotation, I can perform an O(n) rotation. To give this a very specific form. Where I put the number in the last component. Okay, so it points in the nth dimension. In the nth direction. Okay, so what's interesting about that? Well, all other components minimized at 0 in the usual way. So everything about 1 through n minus 1, so that's all of these, 1 through n minus 1, they're going to behave in exactly the same way as the original theory did, but just for a smaller number of parameters. And recall that for on, this is specific to the example that we're considering, but there's always going to be an example like this. For on, because it's a rotation group, there are n times n minus 1 over 2 generators. I.e. group degrees of freedom. So if I have n dimensions, I can have rotations for each direction in that space. I have n minus 1 directions that I can perform rotations about. And then to avoid double counting, there's a 1/2. So in three dimensions, 3 times 2, 6 divided by 2, that gives me 3, so I can do rotations about x, y, and z. And what we note about this is that we've just gone from having n degrees of freedom for rotations into n minus 1. Degrees of freedom in the vacuum state. Oh, maybe I don't have to go that high. Okay, so now let's expand. So if we expand about the minimum, I can just rewrite phi in a more suggestive way. So, I'm going to have pi 1 of x, pi 2 of x, dot, 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 pi n minus 1 of x. And then for the last component, the one that is doing interesting things, I'm going to call that v plus sigma. V phi is the usual v that's defined on the other page. And now I'm just writing it as a shifted field. The Lagrangian, so there's an n minus 1. O n minus 1 symmetry that remains for all the pi's. And we can write the Lagrangian now just by adopting this change of notation in the following way. So reflecting the O n minus 1 symmetry, we're going to have del mu pi. I'm going to call this pi vector just to denote this n minus 1 dimensional object. Pi vector. I'm going to have the kinetic term for this. That's going to be unaffected. What's interesting, though, is now, well, one of the many things that's interesting is that there's now a genuine mass term, as we might expect. So the mass term reflects the fact that we're sitting at a minimum. So this is a mass for sigma. But we're also going to get different kinds of interactions. So there's going to be root lambda mu sigma cubed minus root lambda mu pi. Well, I'll write it in the invariant way. Pi dot pi times sigma minus lambda over 4. Sigma to the 4th minus lambda over 2 pi dot pi sigma squared and minus pi dot pi squared. And so true enough, in this vacuum state where we've shifted the fact that we're not living at zero all into this one component, has given us terms that are all O n minus 1 symmetric. And the vacuum obscures the full O(n) symmetry of original theory. Of the original theory. So this is one observation. Another observation is that all the pi's are massless. So they're all massless, and the third observation is that sigma has a mass. Has mass 2 mu. Yes?
Where did your third origins come from?
They came from expanding this, because all of the original dot products that we had here are still around. I've just changed notation in this way. So there's still terms that involve the nth component, and that's this. And so those are now getting expanded. Yeah. Sorry? Oh, the handwriting is probably not very good. You mean in this?
Yes.
Oh, I'm just saying that so all, well, it's shorthand, but the resulting theory has an O(n) minus 1 symmetry in the ground state. Yes.
So in the beginning, we had n massless fields because the m term had different signs, so we couldn't count it as mass of the...
Well, I mean, technically what we had was a complex mass for everything. So the theory is unstable, right? It was built around an unstable minimum. So this is actually what it was. And before we specify, well, when we write the theory like this, we don't really know what's going on. We only have a right to talk about masses once we've expanded in a way that maps on to what we know about Feynman diagrams and so on. A theory that looks like this, the one with the wrong sign. I don't know if I wrote it down in the way. But okay, so once you've made this replacement, you've got the wrong sign, all bets are off. You have to expand around the right vacuum or the theory doesn't make sense. Okay. And so what we've seen is that the thing that ended up getting shifted by the vacuum expectation value, or the VEV, and from here on out we'll always call the vacuum expectation value of a field the VEV. And that's standard. But we noticed that the thing that gets shifted ends up getting a mass around the vacuum state, and that we end up with a bunch of fields that are massless. So this is a pretty generic conclusion. The massless fields are called Goldstone bosons, after Jack Goldstone, but technically they're Goldstone Nambu bosons. And this is the first example that we have of Goldstone's theorem. Before I move on to Goldstone's theorem, let's just do a quick accounting here. So we started with O(n) symmetry with n times n minus 1 over 2 generators. So we ended with, after expanding, about the vacuum, we ended up with an O n minus 1 symmetry with n minus 1 times n minus 2 over 2 generators. And so what's the difference? So the difference is actually n minus 1. So this is what you would get if you just took n times n minus 1 over 2 minus n minus 1 n minus 2 over 2. And that difference exactly maps on to the number of massless fields. Ah, crap. Okay. And this is a general result. The way that we would describe this situation is that we would say that phi gets of ev and breaks on down to on minus one. Okay. But there's nothing super special or exciting about the ON example. There's a general Goldstone theorem. Well, Goldstone Nambu. I always try to remind myself to say Nambu because it's often just the Goldstone thing in common usage. So the Goldstone theorem. Is that for every broken continuous symmetry, there are massless fields. Massless fields and the precise number depend on the number of broken generators. Number of and so generally for any group that has a or well for any theory that has a continuous symmetry, I can write the Lagrangian as some kinetic term minus some potential, and we're not going to be super concerned about what's happening in the kinetic term. So let the phis here be transform under some group G. It's a continuous symmetry group. Not necessarily. Not necessarily gauged. The important thing is that it's a continuous symmetry. So if we had a discrete symmetry, say like some sort of parity or reflection symmetry that only respected transformations where you discretely take one of the fields into, say, minus itself, then that wouldn't necessarily be a situation that's captured by Goldstone's theorem. It's important that there's a continuous parameter. And it can be a gauge symmetry, and it can be a global symmetry. A gauge symmetry contains a global subset. So I could take any gauge transformation that I would normally make it a global one so that I choose the gauge parameter to be the same for every space-time point, and that gives me a global symmetry, and so they're both captured under this umbrella. And now also let phi a zero. So A is just a component of this thing that I'll sometimes call a vector, but I hope it's always clear. So let phi A0 be a vector of numbers that minimize potential V. I don't need to write that. So what we're going to demand is that dv d phi a about phi a equal to phi a zero is zero. Okay. Once we've got this, now we can Taylor expand. the function v. So now my v of phi is going to be v sum phi 0. Phi 0 is just a number, but I can think about it as a vector, so I don't have to rotate into the last component necessarily. Yeah?
Sorry, can I just ask, what does it mean, gauged symmetry group G?
Okay, so there's a distinction between, so a gauge symmetry is one where there's a gauge boson, right? So we need a gauge boson because, and in fact, I'll just make a little digression here. So let's say I've got some fields from the ON example, right? So there's some phi A, and I perform a global symmetry, global transformation. So RAB times phi B, right? This is just something that contains constants. So for every single space-time point, so this will be a field. It's got some space-time dependence. This is a field that has space-time dependence, but this does not. And the important thing about it being constant is that when I consider the derivative of, say, these things, here's a kinetic term that's invariant under these rotations. The matrix just moves straight through the derivatives, right? But if it's a gauged symmetry. So this was for global. If it's gauged, then what I would do is I would say phi A goes to RAB of X times phi B of X. And now it's problematic because now this term is no longer invariant because there's some product rule that applies to the element itself.
The corresponding symmetry group which is dependent on space-time.
Yeah, so in this case, what we do is we say, all right, it's not just a normal derivative, but, well, we would take the usual derivative and write it as a covariant derivative, minus ig a mu, say, where this is just some number. And we give the spin 1 object here a certain kind of transformation rule. So we would say, okay, a mu goes to a mu minus 1 over g times the derivative of some function of x, say. So this is the abelian example. It can be more elaborate, but the point is that the kind of thing that we have to add to compensate for the other terms that show up because of the product rule will map on to a thing that we would identify as a gauge symmetry in the usual sense, just like in classical electromagnetism. U1 maps on to classical E&M, and more elaborate groups will map onto things like SU3, QCD, and so on. But the Goldstone theorem applies to both scenarios. It's just that more interesting things happen if we're also going to be dealing with gauged stuff. We'll deal with gauged stuff a little later. Let's just talk about the global case first. So what we've done so far is we've considered a theory that has some sort of symmetry, and I don't care about what that symmetry is. It matters only that it's continuous. There's some object phi that transforms under that symmetry, and there's some potential energy function that may or may not be minimized at zero. We're defining phi a sub 0 to be the number that minimizes the potential. So I can put it in some sort of vector, which I'll also call in that way. And then when I take the first derivative of v with respect to phi, then and I evaluate it at that number or that vector that might correspond to that number. I could always do the trick that we did last time and rotate it into one of its components. I'm going to have 0 because I'm sitting at a minimum. So I can expand this. So the first term is going to be 0. So I don't have to consider any sort of linear term in my Taylor expansion. But what we would have is something like phi a minus phi a sub 0 times phi b, phi b sub 0. Maybe I should move this up a little bit. So there's del squared v, del phi a, del phi b, phi 0, phi b, phi b 0. And I realize that I'm being a little confusing and switching back and forth between calling this a vector and a number. Really, if there's a symmetry involved, the potential is really only going to depend on it's some number and it's minimized by some other number. That's at least what it has to be in the if you're not sitting in the vacuum state. This function is just invariant under these transformations. And so this vector I can call at minimum. There's some vector that might be phi 1, 0, phi 2, 0, dot, 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 phi n, 0, if it's got n objects. And the norm of this thing is going to be some number that's just the number that minimizes this function. I hope that's clear. And now we're doing a Taylor expansion plus higher order stuff that we don't care about. And this we can identify as the mass squared term for this theory. Okay. So that's always true for the coefficient of the quadratic piece. And we're evaluating everything at the minimum. So now, consider transformations. Oh, crap. Of the original phi A fields. So I can always have a transformation that takes a specific component of this to some delta A of all the phis. So now I want this to be infinitesimal, which is totally fine because we're dealing with a continuous symmetry. So I can always just choose some element that's closely connected to the identity matrix. And we can assume, it's not important that we assume this, it's just easier for the purpose of putting it on the board, that the kinetic term and potential are separately invariant. So that's going to be true in just about every example that we consider. It's not absolutely required for Goldstone's theorem. Makes life easier, though. And if that's true, we can write down V, which depends on these phis, in the following way. We can say that V is equal to phi A plus alpha delta A of phi. Okay. Notice that I'm writing this suggestively as a function of the fields themselves, because in the case of a rotation, say, all I'm really doing is shuffling the fields amongst each other. And now we can take the derivative. Before we take the derivative, let's just expand it first. So let's expand this expression in alpha. So if I expand this in alpha, the right-hand side can be written as V of phi A plus alpha delta A of phi times dV d phi A plus some other stuff, but this is infinitesimal, so that's all I care to keep. And so this will balance against that, which means this term has to be 0. So we need delta A of phi dv d phi A to be 0 for all A. And now we take the derivative. Take a derivative with respect to phi. So what we're going to do is get two terms. So there's going to be d del A with respect to phi B times dV d phi A. We're going to have delta A of phi times d squared V d phi A d phi B. And that's still equal to zero. And now evaluate it at phi zero, at minimum. So if we evaluate it at the minimum, this term is zero, just by definition. First derivative of the potential is minimum is zero at the minimum, which means this term has to be zero all by itself. And so there are two possibilities. So if delta A of phi 0 is 0, then the transformation doesn't... affect the vacuum state. Okay. So this is possibility one. Or two, delta A of phi is not zero at the minimum, in which case del squared V, del phi A, del phi B at phi 0 is 0. In other words, this thing is an eigenvector of m squared ab, and it's got mass 0. Eigenvalue of 0. And so Goldstone's theorem is proved. So if you've got a continuous symmetry and there are transformations that are not invariant under the vector that we write down in the vacuum state, then there's always going to be something that corresponds to those transformations that's a degree of freedom that has mass zero. Oh, that's just the definition of the second derivative matrix. Yeah, good. So this is different. Oh, and I should just, as a nitpicky comment on the side, m squared ab has a non-negative eigenvalues. Has non-negative values because by stipulation, we demand that it's at a minimum. True, or at least local minimum. And of course, MAB is equal to MBA, so it's a symmetric matrix because it's defined in terms of partial derivatives and partial derivatives commute. Okay. Well, sorry about that. I hope it's not a problem for anybody that that one went up. Okay, so what have we learned? That if you break global symmetry, well, a continuous symmetry, there are massless degrees of freedom. DOF, and that's true. It's always true technically, but in practice, you always get caught up on this thing. In practice, it means that really only true for global symmetries. So let's consider the case of a gauge symmetry, just to see the difference. So for a gauge symmetry where the transformations depend on position, we have a slightly different setup. So I'm going to consider the simplest gauge theory. This is just going to be a U1 example. And there's going to be a complex scalar. So there's a complex scalar phi, phi of x. The Lagrangian is going to have the kinetic field for a gauge, or the kinetic term for a gauge field, where f so is just the usual relativistic form of electromagnetism. I'm writing down d mu phi squared. I don't have to put a 1/2 because now it's a complex field. So the conjugated version is considered separate. And now let's do the usual thing. So now there's a plus. The plus is important. Plus mu squared, just want to get the factors of 2 right, plus mu squared phi star phi plus lambda over 2 phi star phi quantity squared. Okay. The covariant derivative is the usual derivative minus I times G times A mu. This is just the U1 coupling constant. And of course, we can't write down a mass term. So no mass for A mu. This is not gauge invariant. So it's not gauge invariant because when we perform U1 transformations, so under a U1 transformation, phi of x goes to e to the I alpha of x times phi of x, and A mu goes to A mu minus 1 over g del mu of that same function alpha. And it has to be the same function because this thing, the covariant derivative now, when it acts on the transformation part, it brings down an alpha. When you shift the gauge field, the 1 over g cancels off the fact that you're multiplying by g, and then whatever dependence you had on alpha cancels out, so the kinetic term's invariant. The potential is manifestly invariant because all the interesting things about the gauge transformation are living inside the phase. I conjugate it, I multiply them, they disappear. And this thing is just separately gauge invariant. So it's all by itself. This is unique to abelian field strength tensors, F mu nu. For the non-abelian case, it would be a little different. So if we had a non-abelian gauge field where the transformation rule were a little more elaborate, there would be additional terms here. And those additional terms would not be gauge invariant, but when you multiplied through with the appropriate contravariant F mu nu in the non-abelian case, the product would remain invariant. But the mass term for the gauge field for the spin 1 field would look something like this, A mu, and that's just bad news. So that's not going to be gauge invariant because our transformation rule just shifts the A's. There's no compensation here, so we're not allowed to write it down. Now, so we've got maybe about 15 minutes. So I'll just say a few things that I intended to say for the next lecture. But really, who cares about gauge symmetry? Why do we care about gauge symmetries? We say, OK, so I can't write down a mass term for a gauge field. Who cares? Why are gauge symmetries so important? Well, it turns out that, for the Nobel Prize in 1999, so this went to Tuft and Veltman. They showed that gauge theories are renormalizable, whereas spin one theories with explicit mass terms are not. And so we'll remind ourselves that if a theory is renormalizable, that means that you only ever need a finite number of counterterms in your theory. And once you've specified those, you can make an infinite number of predictions with a finite number of inputs. If you had a spin one, that would no longer be guaranteed if you were to write down an explicit mass term that broke the gauge symmetry. Gauge symmetries are nice because I can bring this board up. So I'm not going to prove this right now, but just a heuristic suggestion that the propagator for a spin one field, if massive, if it's explicitly massive, then the propagator looks something like this, Q mu Q nu m squared over q squared minus ma squared. And this sucks because that means that every time you write down a propagator for a gauge field inside some sort of diagram, let's say we connect them in the following way. So there's some Feynman diagram, not the most elegant Feynman diagram. But I can just add complexity to the Feynman diagram by adding more and more gauge fields. And they're massive gauge fields, or massive spin one particles. These are not gauge fields yet. If I keep adding these, normally what we usually do for a loop is we integrate over d4q. Right? And if we integrate over d4q, normally for scalars, for fermions, the more propagators we add, more propagators is better, because we're adding negative powers to whatever thing we're integrating. But this term sucks, because it's not clear that we're adding a negative power at all. So for this first term, OK, it goes like 1 over q squared. Here, not necessarily, because you've got these additional terms that correspond to the fact that we have an additional polarization state for a spin 1 particle. Whereas for a gauge field, if you start life with a gauge symmetry, then you might recall that there are arc C gauges. Well, it would actually just be Q squared. If you start off as a massless U1 gauge field, then this is a gauge parameter. So I can always choose a gauge in which this term disappears. And if that term disappears, then it's much easier to prove that these theories are renormalizable, because the degrees of divergence that you add by sticking on more of these things, they're not as problematic. Okay? So that's just to suggest why we need a mechanism in the first place. Otherwise, it seems sort of contrived. The other reason is that, maybe you don't care so much about renormalizability, but it turns out that the polarization vectors themselves end up inheriting this dependence. And so if you have scattering processes that involve gauge fields, then it turns out that for the longitudinal polarizations, these are going to grow with energy. So there's just some scattering process that involves a characteristic center of mass energy. The longitudinal polarizations are going to grow with energy. If they grow with energy, you violate unitarity. So that's just bad news. You wanted to build a quantum field theory that was manifestly Lorentz invariant and unitary so that you can conserve probability, and now you're just breaking it by adding this stupid degree of freedom. So what have I done? Okay, well, what I just wrote down here isn't super important. I didn't actually give you very good arguments for it. I just wanted to suggest what was happening. We have about 10 minutes, so I'm just going to erase what I wrote down. Okay, so back to the narrative. So we have a U1 gauge theory. We've added a scalar. It's a complex scalar. We've given it the wrong sign mass. Wrong sign mass, but everything else about the everything about the Lagrangian is manifestly invariant under U1 transformations. So the potential, because we've given it the wrong sign, looks something like this. And we can now expand again about the minimum. Which I'll call V5. We can expand the theory. And phi picks up a vacuum expectation value, so I can write down the vacuum value of phi is v phi, and in this case, for the potential that I've written down, this has the value mu over root lambda. And we can write down phi of x, which is now v sub phi plus 1 over root 2. I'll write curly phi as the shifted field. So this is the real part of whatever we started with. And I'll manifestly write down an imaginary part. So now I've just broken the complex scalar down into its real and imaginary parts. And I've shifted the real part by V sub phi. V sub phi can always be chosen to be real in this example because we have a gauge symmetry that allows us to cancel off any imaginary part, at least in the V part. And so now the new potential we expand the potential in this ansatz. So V of phi is now minus 1 over 2 lambda mu to the fourth plus 1 half 2 mu squared phi squared plus terms that are order phi cubed or c cubed. We only care about the theory up to the quadratic order because that tells us our mass spectrum, at least for the purposes of this example. And so real part gets mass 2 mu squared is m phi squared. So now this is just a real scalar, so I have to put the 1 half out there. And m c is 0, reflecting Goldstone's theorem. But the kinetic term is where the action is. So d mu phi squared, if I expand that out now, it's going to look like del x c squared plus root 2 g v phi a mu del mu c plus g squared v phi squared a mu. Okay, plus other crap. But we have a mass for the scale, for the spin one particle. So ma squared is 2g squared v phi squared. Okay? So everything that we've seen so far is realized. So there's a mass term for the spin one particle. There's a massless Goldstone boson. But there seems to be a mismatch. So a massless gauge field, the one that we started with, has two polarizations. A massive gauge field has three polarizations. So what's going on? We've gained an additional degree of freedom. But the extra degree of freedom is actually secretly the C particle. It's secretly this because it's not physical. It's not physical here because it's a little subtle. So in the U1 example, it's definitely not physical because we had one gauge field and we broke exactly one generator because the U1 theory that we started with has exactly one generator and it corresponds to rotations in the phase angle. We broke that symmetry in the vacuum state, so we ended up with one massless particle. And that one massless particle can be mapped on to the one particle that picked up a mass. So that's the additional polarization of the gauge field. And to see that it's a non-physical artifact, we can always choose alpha of x. So this is the gauge parameter. So that we take phi into e to the I alpha x. So this is the complex phi. For a very specific choice of this, I can always make it real. And if it's real, then this thing doesn't exist. This term wouldn't be there. We would only have written down the real part and the VEV for the shifted value. And then it would have been clear because we also have to transform a mu into a mu prime with the same transformation, and that additional transformation will give it the additional polarization. So the choice of gauge where this field is real, this is called unitary gauge. Unitary gauge where only the physical degrees of freedom are present. Okay. And I think that's a good place to stop, at least for today.